Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Jessa, nice finishing out the day with some pretty good moves to the upside here in the equity markets.
And then looking ahead to tomorrow, jobs report.
Yes,
so
exactly.
We've talked a lot about the blackout period for Fed speakers this week, but we do have the jobs report coming tomorrow. So that will be very much on investors' radars. Also, average hourly earnings will be a part of that report, which we know Fed Chair Jerome Powell and other policymakers are going to watch very closely ahead of their decision next Wednesday. And also ahead of that decision on Wednesday, too, we have CPI next Tuesday,
yep.
Paul. So still a number of indicators ahead of the Fed's decision. So things we need to keep our eyes on.
Yeah, and just taking a look at the non-farm payrolls, 185,000 is a consensus tomorrow, and that's up from 150,000 the prior period. So we'll keep that in mind. And average hourly earnings on a year-over-year basis, 4% increase, be a little bit of a decline from 4.1% last period, but still some pretty solid numbers, a little bit slower than what we had seen. But you know, I mean, the unemployment rate, 3.9%,
right,
is kind of the forecast there, and that sounds pretty good. But Michael McKee, he looks at it a little bit more, peels a little bit more of the layers of that onion.
He's the best to do it.
Exactly, right. So, Michael, what are you going to be looking at tomorrow? And, you know, when we get all this data on just kind of the labor market in general.
Well, I think the market is going to focus, assuming we get a somewhere near consensus number for job creation.
Yep.
We'll focus on unemployment and whether that goes up and why it did. If it does, are more people coming into the labor force, which is not necessarily a bad thing, or are we starting to let people go? That'll be the primary question. And then people will be looking at average hourly earnings because they want to see if earnings growth is slowing down enough that the Fed doesn't have to be worried about it continuing to contribute to inflation. We're forecast to hit 4% on a year-over-year basis, and the Fed thinks sustainable is about 3 to 3.5. So we're getting close.
Yep.
So those are kind of the numbers that most people will be focusing on tomorrow.
Will that report adjust anything for the Fed's decision next week, or do you feel like that's pretty much already a done deal, and it's more of just the forecast, the quarterly forecast, and obviously the dot plots that are going to come with that decision?
Yeah, it's pretty much a done deal. The Fed, it would take something going horribly wrong tomorrow, and I'd be back on this show trying
right.
to explain it at this time tomorrow. The Fed has all but signaled they're done raising rates. It would require a lot for them to do something at this meeting, and probably not as much in tomorrow's report as it would be the CPI next week.
Right, on Tuesday.
So I don't think you're going to have to worry about the Fed out of tomorrow's report. It'll spur conversations about next year and when the
right.
Fed might or might not cut rates, but not anything for next week.
So the Fed, I'm not sure what the right word is, but I guess they're prepared for the unemployment rate inch a little bit higher. Is there a point where it gets beyond where they're comfortable? Like, is it like have a five handle and then they said, oh boy, and then they really need to be maybe a little bit more aggressive here?
Well, they were forecasting 4.1% by the end of the year. So we're sort of in the range and
okay.
may come in lower than that. But if it got above if we had a jump like we did a couple of months ago of about 0.3 and we went up to 4.1% from 3.9, or we went up to 4.2, that would get their attention. If we got over 4.5, that would start to raise concerns there. The speed of it and the composition of it would also matter to the Fed, and what else is happening with inflation. They are expecting unemployment to rise because their job is to squish down on demand.
Yep.
And that, in theory, should lead to fewer employees needed, and so unemployment rises. But the speed would concern them if it was quick, and if it started to get too high, of course, by that time, they would probably already be acting.
I'm glad you're here, because something I've been thinking about is the rotation for Fed voting members each year. So Austin Goolsbee, Patrick Harker, Lawyer Logan, and then Neil Kashkari, currently voting members this year, but won't be next year. So then we're going to have Loretta Mester, Thomas Barkin, Raphael Bostic, and then Mary Daly will come back as voting members for next year. How do you think this, when you have those rotations, because in recent years, especially as inflation was very elevated, it seemed like everybody had to have these unanimous votes as far as trying to tame inflation. But when you're going into a year and stock investors are betting that they're going to be rate cuts, when you have a rotation changing like this, how do you view that? Are things really going to be that different? Could that potentially change the expectations for how soon or later rate cuts could potentially come?
I think people make too much of that. The people who are coming on are generally centrists, with the exception of Loretta Mester,
mm-hmm.
and she's leaving in June. So I don't know that we'll see a lot of pushback. You're right, we get a more unanimity when it's very obvious what the Fed should be doing, which for the last year or so has been very obvious that they should be raising rates. And when you get into a situation where it's a close call, should we hold or should we cut rates, then you could see a dissent or two from whatever it is the Fed decides to do. But I think we're not going to see any major splits among them. They're going to move slowly, even unless we have a recession. They're going to move slowly. So even if they do, it's not going to force a lot of people into an uncomfortable vote.
So the University of Michigan, some good football players there.
But they also, so they'll tell you.
Yes. And they also have some good economic data. And they put that out, and expectations and inflation outlook and things like that. Do economists, do they care? Does the market really care about some of this data?
The market doesn't really care about the and the Fed doesn't really care about the sentiment indicator.
Okay.
How people are feeling. Alan Greenspan summed it up very well years ago when he said, "We watch what they do, not what they say." Talking about consumers. The expectations for inflation have become moderately more important because the Fed has made a big deal out of inflation
point.
Expectations being the anchor for inflation, and they don't want to see expectations rise too much, both on the consumer or market side. Market side right now is looking at 2 to 2.5% inflation out 4 or 5 years, which is perfect for the Fed. But Americans are looking at 4.5% now. Mm-hmm. The sentiment indexes, people always overrate what inflation is, and if you go ask any American, they'll probably tell you now it's 6 or 7%, just because they don't know what inflation is. Even if you allow for that, it's a little bit higher than both the Fed would like to see and that you would expect, given the fact that food prices have stabilized, gasoline prices are way down,
right.
And yet people are still thinking there's a lot of inflation. They're looking at price levels rather than the rate of change, which the Fed looks at. So there is kind of a difference there. But as long as people don't start thinking inflation is going to go so high, they have to march into the boss's office and ask for more money, which, of course, we would never do.
No.
Here.
No.
Never.
No.
Never.
Hey, you know, I was out gallivanting in the
gallivanting.
City, Midtown, yesterday evening.
For your birthday.
Yes.
Big birthday.
People were out and about, spending. Streets were packed. You couldn't get near the Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center. I mean, people were out. It feels like the consumer is in pretty good shape. I don't know.
Well, people tell pollsters that the economy is lousy, but my situation is good. People have jobs. I mean, we have 97% employment. And so it isn't a terrible time, and it's there's more and more talk of this. It's like, poor Joe Biden. I mean, he's presiding over a good economy and people yep. don't believe it for a variety of reasons. But things aren't bad right now. So Americans on their own individually are quite happy to go out and buy Paul a hot chocolate on his birthday.
Exactly. See, that's how we roll out there. All right, Mr. McKee, thank you very much. We appreciate it. Michael McKee, international economics and policy correspondent. And Jess, I mean, again, the restaurants are packed, the bars are packed. The Fifth Avenue, you could barely walk down. I mean, that's how crazy it was.
You know, we'll get actually an update on retail sales next Thursday, so the day after the Fed decision for the month of November. So this will give us a read, especially on the holiday spending. We already got a lot of that Cyber Monday and Black Friday data that were at records. So we know it was really strong last month, but that's going to be interesting to see what that data looks like for the consumer fall.
Yeah, and I'll shout out to the tree, the folks that did the
yes.
tree at Rockefeller Center.
It's amazing.
Awesome this year. I mean, we just walked by it. It looks awesome.
I mean, we've got
always.
A tree here, too, at Bloomberg, but
yes,
not
we do.
Quite
we have
as
a very
big
good
as that
tree.
One.
So if you're around, you know, the Bloomberg HQ, come check out our tree in our courtyard. Pretty darn cool. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization. We live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey,
always the best tunes.
Paul Brennan, the producer here.
I mean,
picking the music today.
Taste. Always. They always bring the musical game here. All right, Jess Metten, Paul Sweeney. We are live here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. We're streaming live on YouTube, so you can head over to YouTube.com and search Bloomberg Radio. We're sitting in for Tim Stenovic and Carol Masser. Let's talk one of the really cool news items of the day. SpaceX tender offer said to boost value to $175 billion. So I guess they're going to be tendering for some of the shares owned by employees. Mm. And the tender value, again, implies a valuation of $175 billion. That's a lot for a space company, which
is
pretty cool. Katie Roof joins us. She's a VC deals reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on Zoom from Los Angeles. I know, Katie, you're used to numbers like this out there in in California and LA and Silicon Valley. Talk to us about what SpaceX is doing here and how this is going to work.
Sure. And so this is actually a record for a U.S. private venture-backed company, $175 billion. It's $95 a share for the tender offer. just 6 months ago, they were valued at $150 billion. A year ago, they were valued at $137 billion. So this is a big increase for an already highly valued company. And it really is bucking the trend because, as we've seen in Silicon Valley the last couple of years, the companies are struggling to maintain their billion-dollar valuation. But people that I talk to are big believers in SpaceX.
So talk to us about sort of the issues moving forward for SpaceX, because they're in a unique situation right now.
Sure. So they have two core businesses. They have their rocket launching business, but they also have Starlink, their internet business that's satellite related. And so a lot of the investors tell me that the reason that they're investing is because they are really bullish on Starlink. It's our understanding, and we've reported, that Starlink is eventually going to be spun off of SpaceX and go public someday. And so a lot of the investors are trying to get in on that.
Do either of you know where they launched their rockets from?
No.
Boca Chica, Texas.
Wait, really?
Yes. It's literally, if you go
Boca Chica, Texas.
It's literally the most southern part of Texas. It's like right next to the...
I feel like I should have known this. You should have known. South Texas.
It's unbelievable. I mean, who figures out
got
Boca
me there,
Chica?
Paul.
It's right on the border with Mexico. Apparently, they're building all this infrastructure, and they got rockets down there. And
it's amazing.
Yeah, isn't that cool?
Well, you know, I'm going to be down there this weekend.
I think you should
maybe
go
I should swing by and check this out.
Swing by Boca Chica. So, I mean, Katie, how often does it happen that a company will, I guess, give liquidity to its employees that, you know, through these tenders?
So SpaceX does it more often than most. They've been doing it roughly every 6 months recently, but it's really a case-by-case basis with companies. Some companies don't want to do a lot of this because it makes it harder to have investor demand if they want to raise a round for the company, if there are already a lot of shares that have been available on the market. But what SpaceX is doing here is providing an opportunity for employees to go and buy that house, because if they don't sell these shares in a tender, they have to wait for an eventual IPO. Otherwise, their net worth is just on paper. So that this is really to help insiders have some liquidity, and they're able to do this because they have tremendous demand. And it goes without saying, Elon Musk, who is the founder of this business, is a very, very controversial figure. He's recently made statements that have hurt advertisers on X, formerly known as Twitter, but we see still plenty of investor demand for SpaceX.
Hey, Katie, do we know who buys these shares from the employees?
A lot of them are VCs or other high net worth individuals, accredited investors, could be hedge funds, it could be broad groups of institutional investors, but it's a mix.
That's interesting. So what do you think is sort of the timetable kind of moving forward here as far as how all of this ends up playing out?
Well, our understanding is that they just decided on the price, or they were on the verge of deciding the price when we got a hold of it. The tender is just getting started. It's just underway. I would imagine that they're going to try to do as much as they can before the holidays, but I'm not sure if it will formally close before the end of the year.
Katie, you're the VC deals reporter. Talk to us about your world these days. Are VC companies getting funded? If I have a really cool idea, can I go to Sand Hill Road and raise some money here? Give us a sense of what the environment is like.
Well, if you're doing an AI related company, they're all ears, and they'll be writing you checks before you know it. But for everything else, for other than outliers like SpaceX, it's been really slow this year, particularly at the growth stages, which I cover. Sometimes at the seed stages, they're not as concerned about the broader macro environment because VCs tend to invest on a 10-year time horizon, and so they can be bullish about the future. But companies that raised in like 2021 are often considered to be overvalued because the market, you look at tech stocks, they've gone down for the most part considerably since then, and that's affected valuations throughout the whole ecosystem. So right now it's a tough time to be a startup that raised money and that wants more money, but if you're just getting started, sometimes there's there's room for opportunity still.
For those who don't know, Katie Roof is one of our star reporters here at Bloomberg, constantly breaking news out of Silicon Valley. From your purview being over there and what you were just walking us through, especially on the back of what happened with some of those regional bank issues back in the spring and a lot of those tied to different Silicon Valley banks, what is it like in the mood and the atmosphere as far as how things have come and gone over the past 9 months since then?
So there's fewer holiday parties this year.
Oh, we were talking about that earlier. Yes, we were. Apparently there's a story on the terminal, more pickleball and guac, Katie.
Yeah, so my understanding and talking to some venture firms, there's still some, but some felt that it was a bad look to throw a holiday party this year. You look at their last 2 years where there have been very few IPOs. The M&A is often very disappointing prices, so they're not bringing in a lot of money, and so they felt that it looked bad for some of them to be throwing big splashy events. And Silicon Valley Bank actually used to be the sponsor of a lot of these events. Interestingly, I still see their name on some parties because they're still alive with their new owner, but wow. I would imagine that it's a different scenario than it was 2 years ago.
And are the VC funds, are they still out there fundraising, or is that also kind of slowed down?
Sure. And so I think, again, it's a split between the stages. So the earliest stages, a lot of them have had great returns and have continued to raise new funds for seed stage investing. But what you're seeing is a lot of the crossover funds, the pre-IPO investors, really got burned in this market. And so what we're seeing is some of them struggling to raise new funds or raising smaller funds or trying to change their strategy to invest in either the earlier stages of VC or just go back to investing in the public markets if that's what they were doing before.
Yeah, interesting. It's just a tough time. I think people are just uncertain. I'm just looking at the NASDAQ, you know, still 10% off of the high. So if you're valuation sensitive, that kind of number kind of gets your attention here. Katie Roof, thanks so much for joining us. Katie Roof, VC deals reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us on Zoom from the awesome offices for
yes,
Bloomberg in
I've heard
Los
about
Angeles.
This. Yeah. I gotta go visit sometime soon.
Yeah, looking very cool. It's out there in Century City, nice part of town there, overlooking Bel Air Country Club, I believe, is the one kind of splashy. It's what you would expect from Bloomberg News in LA.
I'm still thinking about what you told me about South Texas, where the launch.
Oh, Boca Chica, we'll go.
So yeah. I'm gonna be down in South Texas this weekend, officiating a wedding. So
I don't know how you get there.
I'll figure it out.
Yeah, flying to Houston and then I think you drive. You know, you just keep driving. All right, we're gonna have more coming up. S&P 500 ended up the day up 0.8%. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Turn out the lights.
Hey, Charlie.
The part is over. They say that all.
Nice.
I like that intro.
Nice.
Because this Bloomberg Business Week headline really got my attention because I'm all about, you know, flexing the corporate Amex card or whatever we're using at the time here. Era of 800. And I got a story about that. Solomon Smith Barney.
Ooh, some stories,
wow.
I'm sure.
Please tell us. Crushing. Era of $800 dinners and luxury car bonuses is over. At Salesforce. Joel Weber joins us. He's the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. Drake Bennett, technology reporter, Bloomberg Business Week, on Zoom from Bloomberg headquarters in New York. And Brody Ford, apparently somewhere, enterprise reporter, Bloomberg News, on the phone somewhere, undetermined, keeping a secret location.
Stay mysterious.
Great story, Joel. I mean, first of all, it's Salesforce.com. Everybody cares about Salesforce.com, Benioff, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, luxury car bonuses?
It was a great time to be in tech sales. And actually, the pandemic even made that even more so,
yeah,
because they just staffed up and kept selling. But then some things started to change. And I've always been really fascinated with Salesforce as a business. And it has become expansive and actually really, you know, created a whole industry, and that's a big credit to its founder, Mark Benioff. But this is sort of a new era for Salesforce. Tell us more, Brody.
Yeah, at some point, you got to stop spending like a startup. And that's what investors told Salesforce this year. They pretty much said that, hey, if you can't keep growing sales the same way, you have to start cutting costs. And yeah, like the headline says, I mean, some of these costs are $800 dinners. And the more mundane stuff is the insane commissions you can get off of selling things. I mean, I always say that I picked the wrong industry because I would speak to people who are about my age, got into the same, at the same time, they're now working in tech sales, making $400,000, $500,000 without a whole lot of experience. You know, I mean, it was just gangbusters. I mean, Benioff told me that selling software was never easy, except for during COVID. It was just firing on all cylinders.
So what's happened? What's the change like within the company?
Yeah, they've just had to get more serious. I mean, they the obvious one is firing 10,000 people, right? I mean, that's the one that most of us read about. But it's even simple stuff like, okay, now when you sell a piece of software, you can't have 10 people all get a commission off of that, right? You can't, as you said, have the $800 dinners. It's really trying to pare back all these expenses that made it such a distinctively fun place to work in many ways.
You know, 2023 has been, even for the technology companies, a year of cutting costs. And I think the greatest example of that, or the one I think investors might know the most, is Meta.
Yeah.
The stock just was ripping this year on, you know, yeah. Zuckerberg saying, we're not going to spend like drunken sailors on this metaverse. We're going to actually focus on costs. And I guess that's...
It tends to go well with investors when you can bring in that cost and you know show that there's a return on investment. But yep. It can come at the expense of culture. So Drake, I want to just bring you in here and also just talk about the industry, because ultimately what we're talking about is something that Benioff pulled out of his brain and then created, and that's SaaS. And so talk to us about, you know, just the economics of a business, a software sales business, where you no longer have to have, you know, the typical kind of infrastructure, and what that kind of can accomplish for investors and
yeah.
companies.
I mean, Salesforce is, I mean, I think for a lot of people, it's not, like when people think about Silicon Valley, Salesforce isn't necessarily the first company that comes to mind. And, you know, there's this idea that Silicon Valley tells about itself to the world, which is that the value of its, you know, all of its wealth and its growth comes from these like brilliant ideas that software engineers have. But there's kind of this other explanation for at least a lot of the recent growth there, which is these armies of salespeople that companies have. And Salesforce really pioneered this. And as you point out, it's linked to this business model that they basically pioneered, which is, you know, rather than selling software, you know, on like a CD-ROM or a disk, like you put it on the cloud, and then you go out and you sell.
Revolutionary.
Yeah, I mean, you know, software as a service is the, you know, SaaS is this thing that everyone's heard now, with maybe without even kind of like fully realizing what non-SaaS is. And, you know, so there's all these companies that are basically modeled on Salesforce, which is like you sell enterprise software, you sell software to other companies, and you put
other,
it on the
other
cloud.
Other salespeople.
Right. And so there was this weird dynamic, like Salesforce grew an enormous amount in the last few years, and especially during COVID. And what it was basically doing was selling these software leases to other companies that were using these tools for their growing sales forces. So it was kind of this, Ponzi scheme is an incorrect term, but it's basically like this weird dynamic where like everyone was growing, and so Salesforce was growing, and then basically at a certain point that reversed. And so what you saw was that as sort of all these other software companies were shrinking, Salesforce had to shrink too. And so, you know, part of what we were writing about was just this aspect of Silicon Valley that people don't really think about that much, and how it sort of shapes the culture of this company and how it shapes the culture of Silicon Valley more broadly.
Brody, I wanted to bring you back into this conversation. And speaking of salespeople, y'all were writing about how some salespeople were relying on aggression and pressure to close those deals, but also you just need to get people and customers to like you. Walk us through anecdotally in the reporting whenever you were speaking to people about how sort of this process works.
It's a really funny dynamic that comes back to the business model. Because SaaS software, it's a recurring contract. Essentially, you need people to stick around. You think about car sales, door-to-door sales, it's kind of old thing. You're thinking of real hyped-up jocks trying to get you to sign the paper, almost like physical coercion, right? But this is more like they just kind of got an army of, like, for lack of a better term, frat boys. Just people with nice smiles that would just kind of show up and, like, you know, hey, how's it going? The software going good? You need any help? All right, cool. We're here when you need us.
Wow.
You know?
What kind of sales?
And there were just armies of them. You know, they call it the clown car approach because one person could pull up with the sales software, one person had Slack, one person had the DataViz software, and they were all getting paid really good. But again, at some point, companies, when the interest rates started rising, there had been years of buying software gangbusters. The CFO started saying, well, why do we have all these smiles hanging around selling us millions of dollars in software? How did this happen? And so they really cut off the spigot of wealth. And that's really why we saw the style of sales here start to break down a little bit. And it's not just Salesforce. This is really an industry-wide phenomenon.
But what does it look like and feel like at Salesforce, Brody?
So our favorite source in this story, we call him Kenny because it's an alias. He still works there. You know, he said when he first joined, it was all parties. It was great. His phrase now kind of sucks. it's harder than it used to be. You're signing less big deals. Your boss is calling all the time. If you don't make, it used to be that you could not make quota for like a year and a half, 2 years. Maybe then you'd get fired. You know, now if you don't make quota in a quarter or two, you're out of there. You got leaderboards. People are more cutthroat because not everybody can share commissions. It looks more like that kind of car sales environment, right? It looks more like the old school cutthroat. There's a movie Drake likes to reference about when sales gets hard. What is it?
Glengarry Glen Ross.
Yes. A, B, yes. C. Always be closing. Is
it Alec Baldwin?
Yep.
Yeah. So Business Week had a little fun with that one. We were playing around with it with the headlines and the cover lines, and it became the headline inside the magazine, always be cost cutting. Yeah. So there's a new C in town. But Jake, tell us more about what, I mean, the death of the salesman. We talked about that years ago, decades ago, because Arthur Miller wrote a hell of a play. Has that era come for sales software and tech sales now?
I think to a certain extent. I mean, one of the things that I loved getting into in the story was just this whole, like, this whole culture of software sales, which, you know, they're these sort of online influencers who would give you these kind of slightly scammy courses about, like, everything you need to know about software sales. And Salesforce sort of offered this whole curriculum about, you know, this kind of like Dale Carnegie style, you know, sales education. And I think a lot of that is froth, and a lot of those skills probably weren't that useful. As you know, Brody pointed out, that this sort of, there was a sort of a self-perpetuating cycle to this, where, like, if you hired more people, you needed more Salesforce software leases, and so it kind of didn't matter who was selling it to you. And so it may be the case that, you know, you don't need quite as many people out there selling it, and you don't need to pay them that well.
Guys, I don't know what Brody is this kind of the new normal now? I mean, is the party over when you talk to these people?
I think that's what we're seeing here. Oh, I think we're seeing this is all a big part of big tech losing its shine, right? In the last couple of years, we saw big tech losing its shine regulatory. They said, wait, this might not be good for us psychologically. I think this year we see big tech lose its shine economically. That, wait a second, these business models are not impervious. They're not bulletproof. At some point, these jobs that were the golden standard have to become normal, right? I mean, I don't know, like working at GE in 1960 was probably the golden standard. And I think we're starting to see these tech giants become a more standard part of the economy and lose their kind of special edge in terms of being a great job. But they're still, hey, you can still make some money. It's still a good place to work, but it's not what it used to be.
Well, yeah, one of my favorite details was, like, they're talking a lot about how they're going to use AI. You know, and Mark Benioff loves talking about AI.
There it is.
But one of the things they're actually using for right now is basically finding when salespeople are kind of like goosing their numbers and cheating. So it seems like, you know, that's the new reality.
So what do we think Mark Benioff's company looks like a year or two from now? Like, you know, shed the tech sales guys and that cushy tech job. Like, what is a more hardcore sales force look and feel like since it's been such a cuddly, friendly place up until now?
I'm sure this is weird to hear for a tech company, but they're hiring engineers. You know, that's actually what their main focus is now. Is I think they're really trying to invest in new products and figuring out where that next realm of growth is, right? I mean, the products that got them here are pretty mature at this point. And as Drake mentioned, like all companies, they're looking to AI to really accelerate it. I don't know if you've seen Matthew McConaughey on TV wearing the cowboy outfit, talking a bit about AI and who's the sheriff in town. That's Salesforce. I'm not sure I get what it means either, but that's Salesforce.
Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah. Just final question, which Drake, I want to bring it back to you. You've written about a lot of companies, different strategies, different sectors, different industries. You know, if you could, cast the movie for the Salesforce version of the story, like do some casting for us. Who's the salesperson of the year?
The salesperson of the, you mean like who's Kenny?
Yeah.
Like
who would play Kenny? Let's cast Kenny.
Who was that guy, Giovanni Ribisi? That like too obscure from like Boiler Room?
No, he's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
I love that you have energy. That very quick.
I'm impressed.
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, just like nice, sort of like, you know, almost pathologically upbeat kind of person. Yeah. Just, you know. Indefatigable, stellar.
And what about Brody? What about Benioff in the movie version of your story?
You know, he'd probably agree to do it himself.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Anybody.
I mean, how does he feel about the business? I mean, everything's performance is doing great. You know, like what? So how did you know your interactions with him? What do you have to say?
I think he is very aware that they had a long stretch of bad headlines this year. His message right now is that, you know, they always say that it's an Ohana over there. That's his big phrase.
Yep.
What he gave to me was, look, it's Ohana 2.0. You know, it's still there.
Yep.
But we had to.
All right, Brody, we're going to have to leave it there just for time. Joel Weber, Drake Bennett, Brody Ford, Bloomberg Business Week. You can check that out on the newsstands. I got that great story.
The cover issue,
Elon,
too.
The cover, absolutely. Some good stuff. Check that out. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization. We live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car.
I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Jess Mitten, Paul Sweeney here in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio, filling in for Carol Masser and Tim Stenovic, who do have the day off. Not sure who's who, who's Carol, who's Tim here, Paul, but exactly. Looking at the S&P 500 today, up 0.7%. If you look on a weekly basis, a little changed, but this does come following a five-week winning streak that was its longest since June. But who better to chat with us about their market outlook moving forward? Christoph Gleisch, President and Chief Investment Officer at Harbor Capital Advisors, who's actually here in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. I know Paul always loves when people are here in office with us to discuss his outlook and also his investment strategy. I want to pick your brain now that we are into year end here. What's your take as far as positioning wise going into next week ahead of the Fed decision?
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here in person and live. I think this year has surprised a lot of people. It's caught a lot of investors offside. If you think back where we were 12 months ago, supposedly now we should be three or four rate cuts in as the Fed is continuing to try and stimulate an economy coming out of a recession. We know how that sort of playbook played out. And I think what surprised investors is how resilient growth has been this year, how resilient markets have been this year. And, you know, at the moment, your colleague read out, there's a lot of green on the screens. Camp Soft Landing is winning, and it's very much risk on environments at the moment, as it has been in the last 5 weeks.
How do you think about valuation here? Because I think that I'm just looking at my chart of the S&P 500, and boy, that was a heck of a November there. And I'm wondering if we've kind of gotten a little bit too over our skis a little bit in terms of valuation. How do you guys think about that?
So I would say, trying to time markets on a short-term basis, what's going to happen this week or that is pretty difficult to do. I think valuations here are probably say fair, and so we would recommend having a good allocation to equities for investors that are ultimately investing for the long term. Of course, it's a market of many different regions, many different market capitalization. I think there are areas of the market that are looking pretty cheap right now. Hmm.
You talk about in some of the notes you sent us, don't hide out in cash. We've seen the fury into money market funds over the past year being at a record here. What's your view on as far as what's the catalyst when people argue about, oh, well, we're going to put our money in money market funds for the yield, but then if you have these double-digit gains in these major indexes, how do you square that away, and at what point does that move out of money market funds and then into equities?
So I think if you look at any long-term investment chart over any time, only over any reasonable time horizon, there's always a squiggly line at the bottom in decay, and that's always cash. Cash is the worst performing asset class over any reasonable time horizon. So what we would say is hold enough liquidity for your immediate liquidity needs as an investor and what you're comfortable with. As it pertains to what's going to create some of that cash to come out, there's $7 trillion. $7 trillion is a huge number sat in money market funds. And I think in certain areas, we've seen investors wait and wait on the sidelines for this supposed recession that hasn't come. And I think the longer that we continue with this soft landing scenario at the moment, it's going to pull more investors. They're going to begin to start putting money to work. And we're already beginning to see that. And specifically around small cap as well, I think it's a pretty attractive entry point right now.
All right,
small
that's
caps.
Where I wanted to go.
There we go.
I hear small caps, mid caps, small caps, but man, that's a tough place to make money historically. Is it a valuation call that attracts you to the small cap space? Is it just that maybe they haven't performed? Kind of, how do you think about that?
So the answer that we hear most often, and we actually asked this, we held our global market outlook call, and the theme was In Search of Bright Spots yesterday, and we asked our clients around small cap, and the answer that got the biggest response was waiting for the recession before allocating to the asset class coming out the other side. Okay, there's a lot to unpack there. You know, recessions are incredibly hard to kind of forecast and predict exactly, but we get it. We understand that mentality. If you look at small caps, they've effectively been in a recession for the last 2 years. Some colleagues of yours did some great analysis on the Bloomberg terminal the other day, and I saw small caps are currently going through their second longest drawdown in history. It's only coming out of the tech bubble you can compare to this. So if you look at small caps, they are off in the region of 30 to 40% off their peak. And you've begun to see a broadening of the markets. You've begun to see a bid for small caps. And I think investors are already beginning to come back in.
Yeah, that's really interesting that you brought that up, because it's the worst three-year span relative to the S&P 500 when you're looking at the Russell since the late 1990s and the turn of the century. What sectors in particular, when you're looking at small caps, are attractive to you?
So the way that we work at Harbor Capital is we work with boutique money managers across the world that we believe are experts in their own domain. So they do all the day-to-day stock selection. A couple of things I'd say about small cap is it's an area that we think is ripe for skilled active managers to add value. We think a skilled active manager in small cap can add 3 or 4% net of fees. And ultimately, you're outsourcing that day-to-day stock selection to those managers. I think some of our managers at the moment, particularly, again, this is a bit of a contrarian call, like biotech has been absolutely hammered in that space. But there is some optimism building. You know, you can't fall too much further from the basement. And potentially what we might see is some more M&A in the healthcare sector that might put a bid on some of these biotech names. So that was one of the themes that came out of our Outlook call yesterday.
How about the ETF space? That's getting a ton of cash. How do you guys get exposure there?
So we have, we've been in the ETFs now for 2 years. We launched 2 years ago. We now have 14 ETFs. We have about $1.3 billion out of our $50 billion. Are in actively managed ETFs. And we think, you know, a lot of the innovation, a lot of the money flows are going to continue to go to ETFs, especially for taxable clients.
All right. It's interesting. I mean, that's just kind of where the capital's flowing. So you got to have exposure there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And specifically for us, where have we seen money put to work in our ETF lineup? We one of our flagship strategies, the ticker is WINN, W-I-N-N. It's run by Jennison here in New York. It's a large cap growth, concentrated, fully active, transparent portfolio. And it's done phenomenally well. It's up 47 or so percent nice. This year and has outperformed its respective benchmark by about 1,000 basis points.
Well, good stop there. Good start. Christoph Gleisch, thanks so much for joining us. Christoph is a president and chief investment officer of Harbor Capital Advisors. They got about $50 billion in assets under management. And he joined us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio, so he gets a special star there. S&P 500 up 0.75%. This is Bloomberg.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. On Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.